in 45 minutes, and we'll take them in the order that they're listed behind me. So, Matt, if you want to start us off.
Okay, we were to come up with three objectives and then some of the benefits that could flow from that objective. So, of course, we came up with four, but we'll stay within the 5 minutes. The first one, and this is, I think, what occurs to most people, is to try to anticipate an impact of an option. And the first, again, first thought for an objective, first thought of a benefit, is to learn what's possible. And again, not necessarily what's going to happen, because we had a very useful discussion about how a war game is one pass through a series of random events, and it doesn't prove that something will happen, but it can be an indication that it's not impossible. And we went into a lot more on that. Then clarify the need for resources, that if you're doing a war game and you're trying to achieve a particular objective and you figure out that's impossible because of missing resources, that's a pretty good argument for the resources. And then it can also help clarify what you actually want out of pursuing that option. And then the final benefit under this was to try to broaden it, in that when you think about the impact of an option, it tends to be the first thing you think of is a course of action, but you can also anticipate the outcome of buying a tank instead of a helicopter or using a new doctrine or something like that. And one of the real benefits is you get to try new ideas without betting the farm, without betting your budget, without betting your nation. So all good things from the most obvious objective. Then the other one that comes up is if your objective is team building. And there was a very good point that the best objective, the best thing for team building might be some other technique other than wargaming. But if you are using wargaming, it does tend to make your team more cohesive. It gives insights into team members. One of the things the Germans believed in was that you could get insights to how well someone would plan in warfare by seeing how well they did in the wargame, although they said that's not the only criteria. There were many people that were good at the gaming table but turned pale at the sound of a dentist drill. And then unity of effort, people coming together and working on a war game together can do that. One of the things that I think was a very good insight was it can also build cooperation between teams. So if you play a war game with the Brits and the Americans and the Canadians and the Australians and whoever else, that cooperation you build up during the war game could carry over to real events. And we see this in non-war areas, like first responders to natural disasters, people that normally don't work together. They work together in the war game, and that helps. Also, the point made earlier today about muscle memory, that people doing a war game over and over again becomes more intuitive. And then a term I like to use, virtual veterans. You know, our red flag over the Nevada desert, where you're basically shooting your watch, it was very, very successful. When people went to the first Gulf War, both Air Force, Army, Navy, Marines all said this was not as hard as some of these training rotations because they were able to become virtual veterans. And as was pointed out, it's not only does that tend to make people more effective, but you become more effective as a real veteran when you take casualties and lose people, and you normally don't take casualties in a red flag. So a benefit within a benefit. Then we talked about another objective would be if you're just trying to understand your adversary or better understand the situation. And this one of the big benefits is to expose what you don't know. As you're trying to play red, just the effort of trying to play red can reveal some unknown unknowns about your knowledge of him. Also, it tends to spread knowledge of red. So most red teams only have one or two people that really understand red, and during the course of play, that knowledge is spread. You also have what impacts the adversary, what are the adversary's real goals and objectives, and then if you broaden this one a little bit from understanding the adversary to more understanding the situation, you can better understand allies and neutrals and the overall environment by doing a war game. And one of the things we brought up is if you've played a war game in a particular part of the world, you tend to have that geography memorized. It's just kind of burned into your head. And so it gives you some real insights into the overall situation, which you'll remember when it's for real. And finally, and we are still under 5 minutes, they said, you know, an objective can and should be fun. that I think a lot of us in this field kind of apologize for wargaming being fun, but it's been my experience as a teacher that if I can make my lectures more entertaining, they're also more memorable. War games tend to be more engaging, so instead of part of the class sleeping, everybody tends to be part of the effort, and that you can develop this feedback loop where the more fun it is, the more you tend to do it, and so you do it more and you get better at it, so it becomes more fun, so you do it more so you get better at it, and you get into this positive feedback loop that can be very, very beneficial. And that was my group. Anybody in the group, something big I left out?
Well, let's see if we get through them all, and then we'll see if there's anything to be added. So Matt's group on objectives met the objective of more or less of doing it within 5 minutes. Let's see whether the facilitated discussion on facilitators had anything.
So that's the nightmare. Facilitated discussion on what the good roles and skills are of a facilitator and umpire, actually. I'm going to cheat as well. We've got about five in this list, but I'll collapse them into three. The first one we have is self-awareness, and included in that, emotional intelligence. Now, that is to be aware of what you're bringing, but also to be able to read the team or part and understand the team of participants. So we saw as that's part of sense of humour, but also to allow an input from the people in the room. So quite a soft skill, maybe more for a seminar type activity, but an important one nevertheless, we thought. The other essential quality is that we started with neutrality, but changed it to unbiased, seeming to be unbiased. So that you're unbiased as to people's opinions, the way it's going, but that doesn't mean you're passive. So you can have an active involvement, an active input, which will bring me to the next one, my next bullet, but you have to be identifiably unbiased in that sense. Then there's a whole lot collapsed under one big heading to make sure we get away with many more than three. The first one is maintain the aim of the event. In other words, there's that sort of management style of making sure that whatever is happening, you're aware of what you're trying to get from this particular event and make sure it works. So you have that maintenance of the aim, as the military might say. Now, as part of that, this is the cheat, you need sufficient domain knowledge into the exercise that you're facilitating. But, of course, you may also need to use or identify whether you need to use expert advice as part of your XCOM team. So an important skill is to recognise what you do know, but also what you don't know, where you need to bring in some advice to support your facilitation. But the other point that was raised to that was that you don't need... Having too much domain knowledge brings with it the risk of bias. So you could have too much knowledge and try and shape the exercise overtly or perhaps in a less obvious way. Which brings us back to my second bullet about trying to be seen to be unbiased. So those were the three plus a few. The key point is we did check back right at the end and said, okay, the reason for this exercise was to look at what we could learn defence against or as opposed to non-defence and vice versa, the skills and knowledge related to each of those domains. And the conclusion generally was that there is no difference. Actually, they're the same sorts of things. It depends on the particular activity. We have a very rigorous rule-based thing versus a seminar-type activity. But the sorts of skills you need vary between those types, but not driven by whether they're defence or non-defence business areas. Anybody else from the group want to add to that, in case I missed or oversimplified?
And if not, we'll move on to the next group, which is you, Peter.
Okay. Our group was headed by Ivor, and we were looking at commercial off-the-shelf games as opposed to purpose-built or bespoke games and the relative issues associated with those. I learned quickly a lesson in tactics. I chose to sit in direct line of sight to Ivor, and he immediately tasked me to be the spokesperson for the team. But we had a very interesting and very active discussion across the entire room, and the ultimate result of three major points was, first, a fairly obvious and broad one, which is you need to understand what exactly it is you're trying to do if you're going to make use of a game of any sort. And in this particular case, we focused in on tactical training and education for serving officers, which in a sense, Jeremy just reminded us that it applies also to business. There's a tactical level of business education that's involved in gaming. But our focus was on the military, and so the objective was important, and that objective was to help train people in behaving, using their actual systems and their actual capabilities, and potentially even in actual terrain. That was one use. And another use was in trying to get them to build some muscle memory for their tactical thinking. So those were the key objectives that we focused on. We identified, in some sense, three broad approaches to using games of this type. One was the commercial off-the-shelf game. Just get the game, like ASL, and use it. Another was to have a bespoke game where you go out and contract with some industry contractor or build it in-house to develop a game specifically tailored to the needs that you think you have. And the third approach there is, in a sense, a combination of those two, a hybrid, in which you start with an existing game system, such as the mechanized battalion game of Johan that Ivor's mentioned in the past, or ASL or something else, but then tailor that game to your purposes. In particular, there was a lot of discussion about the dangers of bad data or teaching what we call in the US negative training by giving people a sense of how things work, how weapon systems work, that is different from the way they are in reality. So that was a concern with both commercial off the shelf and to a lesser extent, the hybrid game. But the third key element of the process is the trainer, or the, I think the better word is the user. In this case, the user is someone like Ivor, who in his application is a trainer, but there may be other things that you want to do with games. You may want to develop concepts, or you may want to explore different mission types with different kinds of forces. But the user has to be able to adapt whatever game system he's using to achieve his purposes. And that's a critical element, because you can't just take a game, whether it's a bespoke game that you've produced or it's a commercial off-the-shelf game, you can't just take it, hand it to the target audience and say, learn, go do something. Back in the US, we did a study at my organization of the use of a computer game to teach tactics, basic tactics, to Marine Corps intelligence officers at the battalion level. And the key element that we developed, that our analysis identified in that process, was you had to build a connection between the game and what the real-world players have to be doing. In this case, we had to build an example of how you do an intelligence preparation of the battle space in the game world of this computer game. And you saw the same sort of thing in what Ivor showed about the planning process, the seven questions. That connection between the real world and the game world is fundamentally important if the game of any type is going to have the kind of effect you're trying to achieve. And so that was the key elements that we discussed in our session.
Thank you very much. And next, validation and verification.
Yeah, I guess the first thing to say is that mine was probably quite a biased sample. So all of us bar one were military analyst gamers, and so bear some of this in the context of that sort of sample. I guess I'll leave the final part I come to, I think, draws it all together. So these bits initially are just sort of trying to build up to that. Some of the things that came up initially were about the idea about the concerns about the game engine dominating, and you know, how do you know when you get to the point where people are sort of, you know, playing the rules and so on. And that was something that was quite interesting. How do we cope with that? Can we think of ways of perhaps swapping to different game engines if that's appropriate? Not necessarily appropriate if you've got computer-based systems, of course. but those in themselves can cause their own issues about people getting sucked into playing the software, and we know that, and playing the screens. As we were talking about that, we started to explore the idea about the purpose of the game becoming key and perhaps being more evident when you're actually setting up the whole war game and activity and event. We then started to explore some of the other issues that have come up on this, a couple of ones that are related more than anything else. There's this idea about data and the provenance of the data that you've got, you know, particularly as you're trying to sort of ensure this idea about sort of trying to make sure that you've got this sort of audit trail through to various aspects of things as well. When we discussed some of that, there was this issue, particularly in the military sphere, about the classification of some of the data, that some of that could well be on a need-to-know basis, which sometimes will hamper explanation of outcomes and why things happened as well. And that particularly starts to become an issue when you're thinking about some new concepts, new technology. How do you gain those when there are no existing things to compare them with, for example? How do you determine the validity of the things that you're actually playing with? When we start to come on to some of the output in a little bit more detail, we start to think about some of the issues about repeatability. So if I can only exercise or execute one game, because that's all I can afford to do, how much credibility do we place in those outcomes? You know, do I need to run them several times? There are all those sorts of issues there. It comes back to some of the ideas about the data as well, about the simplicity of the things that we can run. And I guess more than anything, it starts to draw it together, this idea that we put up first of all about this fitness for purpose label. So for many people, fitness for purpose is an issue. We've managed to split it within the group to the majority of us in there were providers of output. We had a customer, subsumer of the output in there, so try to get their view as to how they saw fitness for purpose. And I think the analysts and the consumers see it slightly differently. So by and large, it comes down to this idea about end-user credibility. How do we define fitness with purpose? Can we objectively or subjectively measure that, you know, for a particular study activity? There are some suggestions about the pedigree of the activity of the gaming that you've used before can form part of that as well. So I think all those things, when you talk about the repeatability, the data provenance, the classification of things, and so on, all come back to this idea of culminating in a fitness for purpose issue more than anything else. And I think that's something that perhaps needs to be a lot more front and centre whenever we're doing any sort of analytical gaming activities, trying to get a handle on what is actually fitness for purpose for that particular thing. Well, that's it.
Thank you very much. Andrew.
Thank you. We came up with 3 points, but there was a sort of opening and closing observation that were quite interestingly linked to each other, sort of coming full circle. The more astute of you might make that in 5 points, but I'm going to keep it at 3 points with an opening and closing observation. And that is, the first observation is that the clamour of agreement when we started was that bog sats were a bad thing. So park rat. The 3 points were that actually what Graham had asked us to do, even though he'd put it in brackets at the end, was an extremely adversarial thing. He'd put this between all sorts of different things that he was asking us to compare with each other. And what became quickly apparent, and I think I used this expression last year for something that Graham had asked me to do, was that he wasn't just asking us to compare apples and oranges, but actually he was asking us to compare apples, oranges, Wednesdays and penguins, and judge the relative merits of those things against each other. And what was quickly apparent was that it depends, and a combination of all of the above in different measures, depending on what it is that you're trying to achieve, which you had better have understood from the outset, was fast becoming the answer to the question. And laying those things off against each other as a relative meritocracy was not necessarily a good idea. So all of the above, but it depends, bespoke model according to what you're trying to achieve is probably the big answer to that question. So there's point one. Point two, it follows therefore that your planning of that, your structure of that, your facilitation of that is as important as deciding what combination of the above you need in actually running the event, the war game, the product, once you've worked out point one. But point three is that obviously expert opinion and facts are going to be a really important ingredient in however you lace those things together. But maybe it wasn't as obvious as all of that, because very quickly that became a debate on beware the value of facts, beware the factualness of facts, and be particularly wary of anybody who calls himself an expert. So while they're vital, that depends too, and needs to be used in an intelligent way. So those are the three points. Which brings me back to Bogsatz. Because a useful observation at the end, Bogsatz being useless, having been a theme that kept coming back, was that actually, organisations that habitually use a Bogsatz are unafraid to sit around and discuss the relative merits of things that they think that they have concluded, are organisations that by and large are much more open to being persuaded to, or persuading themselves to, take the next step beyond a Bogsatz, which is to try a combination of all of the above, call it a war game, call it what you will, to test their assumptions more thoroughly. Organisations that are prepared to sit round and discuss stuff are organisations that are prepared to discuss how they're going to look into stuff in a bit more testable detail. And as we were getting up to leave, the observation was made that we had come to all of those useful conclusions by using a bog sack.
Well, the hidden victory conditions were that if you all finished in 5 minutes, we would win. So we've all won. That leaves us happily 20 minutes for you to either add comments on your own group, if you think there's things that weren't mentioned here, comments on what you've heard from other group, violent agreement, violent disagreement, points you think haven't been covered. So we've won. We can sit back now.